is the Financial Exchange with Barry Armstrong and Chuck Zada. Your exclusive look at business and financial news affecting your day, your city, your world. Stay informed and up to date about economic and market trends. Plus, get breaking business news every day. And now, the Financial Exchange with Barry Armstrong and Chuck Zada.
It's a quiet day for trading this morning. Not a lot of volatility in terms of stock prices. And I think part of the reason is there's not a lot of economic data coming out today. Tomorrow is going to be a banner day. Tomorrow we're getting inflation data. And you want to talk about a statistic. I'm trying to think right now, what could move the market more? Unemployment data or inflation data? I'd say inflation data.
Yeah, I think with the unemployment data, even though we talked on Friday that the number that we saw, that 559,000, it's the bare minimum that we want to see. It's not a failure like the April report was, but hey, this is the bare minimum. We need to be on a pace of creating at least 6 to 7 million jobs a year, given where we currently stand in the employment picture. So I think you can at
least... Is that how many people are sitting on the sidelines, about 6 million?
It's about 9. Okay.
But it was in there. It's expected that 2 or 3 million are just not coming back at all, right? They aged out or whatever.
Yeah, you have some that have aged out. You have others that have, simply made lifestyle changes and said, look, I'm, not returning to the workforce right now for whatever reason. So I would say in general, my expectation would be you need to get at least another, 7 million people and plus population growth. So we're really running about 10 to 11 million people below where I think we want to be at this point.
What do we say? You say population growth. Do we have any?
Yeah, I mean, you still are adding 200,000 people a month to the workforce.
Yeah, but how many people are leaving the workforce?
That's the net.
The net is
200,000 still.
Wow.
So it still is an accretive position in terms of people coming into the labor force. Mm-hmm. So I think, again, as long as you continue to put up numbers, at least 500,000.
It's got to be pretty lumpy. I would think the numbers in the fall are going to be enormous.
Would think so, but it's really interesting here when you look at this, because there's all kinds of data now. I mean, that JOLTS report that we got, the job openings report
blew
yesterday.
My mind.
Again, the quits rate is up, and this is part of what we're seeing here is, remember, the jobs are calculated on a net basis. Yeah. Quits are way up, so employers added a bunch of people in April and May. It's just you have a ton of people quitting as well, and that's dragging things down and kind of bringing things around. But
when you say they're quitting, they're quitting and taking other jobs.
They may not be.
Yeah.
In some cases, people are not taking other jobs immediately. They're quitting. They might be moving and kind of getting themselves sorted out for a little bit. So it's, again, this is a really... This is the most competitive labor market I've ever seen.
Yeah,
I don't know about you, and isn't it weird to say that at
well,
a
you
time
talk to
where
people.
You have we've got 6% unemployment, the participation rate is well below where it was at the start of last year, and you still sit there and you go, I've never seen employers have to compete for labor like this.
But you and I have talked about this, and we read some Princeton or Yale studies saying that the unemployment benefits weren't keeping people out of the workplace. Where do you stand on that now?
I think they are at this point. I think last year they weren't because those jobs weren't back at that point.
Okay.
The job openings weren't there. Yep. It was not a situation where you had them. I would say at this point, and Mike and I have talked about this, I think that the states that are moving to end that supplemental unemployment by the end of the month, I don't see any problem with it. I think that by July 4th, you could make a case that the entire country could be off them. Now, is it going to be catastrophic that it goes on for 2 more months after? No, it's another 60 days, so it's not the end of the world.
Well, but I'll tell you what, though. If you're the Chatham Bars Inn, right, and you're running your hotel, it is kind of the end of the world because those are the most profitable 2 months of the year you have.
Pay more and raise your prices. It's what Chipotle did yesterday.
Yeah, but is that enough, right? Like Chipotle raised their prices, 4%?
Yeah.
And minimum wage to 15. I don't know that that's going to garner the workers they need. Is that going to, because if somebody's
do it like, again,
yeah,
do it. I mean, this is what it is. This is the world that we are in right now.
It may be temporary. Do you think it's a temporary blip or do you think this is a permanent wage growth? so for the lower paid worker.
When you say permanent wage growth, are we talking about, are we going to see 10% wages bumping each year, or are we just going to stay at these levels and that's the new baseline?
Well, I'll give you an example. A friend of mine runs an inn up on Lake George.
Okay.
Okay. And the people that he had doing housekeeping work for him,
yeah, right,
came to him, there were three of them, and said, look, we'll come back, but you got to pay us cash because we want to continue to collect our unemployment benefits.
I think there's a ton of that going on.
Yeah.
Just anecdotally, I've talked to business owners where that is the case
and
right now.
These guys are doing it because they don't have any choice. And like, it's either that or not open their doors. Because it wasn't something they said, there's a ceiling on how much you can pay in terms of wage, right? Like for housekeepers or and whatnot, and for them to compete with the unemployment benefit, they were talking about $40 an hour.
The more interesting thing for me than those jobs that, again, typically we're talking about, you know, have historically been in the ballpark of minimum wage or close to it jobs, you know, fast food,
gone,
housekeeping.
Yeah.
Here's the thing that's interesting to me. It's not looking at wages in those jobs. Mm-hmm. But the ones that are a tier above, okay, so the ones where if you previously, let's say that McDonald's, the average wage entry level was $11 to $12 an hour.
Yeah.
If that's now moving to $15 to $17,
yeah,
what does that do to the job that previously used to pay $20 an hour? How high does that need to go? Mm. Because those often were jobs that were much more physically demanding, required higher levels of skill. And so if you go and say, hey, I could get $17 working at McDonald's right now, why don't I do that instead of doing this harder work for $20 an hour? I'm only getting an extra $3 an hour,
yep,
and I'm doing all this, you know, tougher work at a higher skill level.
Yep.
I wonder how high those need to go. And
that may be attributing to the quits rate, Chuck, because what you may be having is somebody who's making $17 an hour as a shift manager for McDonald's,
yep,
now can go to Chipotle and make $28 an hour as a shift manager.
But the jobs that I'm looking at are, you know, entry-level municipal jobs, mm-hmm, in much of the country. Not the Northeast, where, you know, you pay more for those.
Yep.
But think about what an entry-level policeman makes in Alabama, just as an example.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And you say, do I want to be making $21 an hour doing this?
Right.
When I, like,
I get shot.
Doing dangerous work, right, my hours are tough, or I can make $17 at McDonald's?
Yeah.
Like, those are the things where you wonder what happens to those roles and how do they fill them, because especially in the municipal budget world, mm-hmm, you can't just raise your wages by 10% in a year.
Right. See, you look at this stretch that we're going through now, and it's a critical stretch. I mean, you talk to people in the hospitality industry, they're talking about, we can't rent out all of our rooms because we can't clean them. We can't fill the restaurant because we don't have enough servers. We don't have enough chefs. They just literally,
yeah,
can't operate at full capacity, and it's due to employment restraint. They can't find the workers.
And I still maintain that, having lived through the last two recessions now, and say lived, having invested through the last two, mm-hmm, recessions now, I much prefer this set of problems to what we saw coming out of 2008-2009.
Mm-hmm.
Just,
yeah,
because I remember that 2009 through 2014 period, how slow the growth was. And the question wasn't, how do I find enough workers? The question was, how do I avoid laying people off to meet my goals? I don't have enough sales. I can't, yep, find enough sales to keep people employed.
Well, and you couldn't borrow money. If you wanted to do a project, say you got a winning bid and you needed to borrow $200 million to renovate Logan Airport,
yep,
you couldn't get the loan to do it.
I would much rather have the problem of too much demand and companies need to innovate and figure out how to solve, mm-hmm, that problem,
yep,
as opposed to no one has any money and we can't make any sales, so we're continuing,
right,
to lay people off.
Yeah.
I much prefer this set of issues to the one we faced 15 years ago.
It's a fascinating study, isn't it? Really? Because we've never had this approach before.
No.
As a country, we've never taken, it's always been the austerity approach. This time it's the spend approach. And it's a real test for modern monetary theory.
And like most things, you may end up with the answer being somewhere in the middle, where it is, hey, we probably should have, you know, tossed a bunch of money at the problem, but maybe not all at once, because now you have all this demand and no way to fill it, because, yeah, the economy can only rebound so quickly.
What is this going to do to inflation data? We're getting inflation data, critical, by the way, inflation data tomorrow. The 10-year Treasury note this morning is telling us they're not too worried about it. The bond market's at, what, 148?
The expectations are that at least for the next few months, it's going to be hot.
Right. Like, you know, 4+, right?
4 to 5%.
Yeah.
So I think that when I'm looking at inflation data right now, I'm kind of punting on it through the summer because you know it's going to be hot. It's we're every day we're talking about shortages somewhere, and that's a huge sign.
Not
of inflation.
Just worker though. You're talking like try and buy a dishwasher today.
My parents had to buy washers and dryers.
Good luck.
They finally found a place, but otherwise they were going to be backed up for 6 weeks. Yeah. You know, so these are the things that we're seeing. So I anticipate inflation being hot through August, maybe even through September. Mm-hmm. I think my real question is, once you do see the expiration of those unemployment benefits, September 7th, show me what we get for September, October, the last 4 months of the year.
Yeah.
And does the trend continue to be hot? Does it accelerate and get even hotter? Mm. I'm not saying that that would happen, but does that happen? Or do we start to see a return back to the 2 to 3% inflation that we've seen for the last 25, 30 years?
So when would you expect inflation to tame down? You think by October? Because my modeling is suggesting you're not going to see a return to normalized inflation until sometime in the first or second quarter of next year.
I think if you're not starting to see signs of it tapering down by October or November, then you got to buckle up for the fact that it's going to be sticking around for an extended period. So I think by October or November, you need to start seeing some signs.
Hey, up next, we're going to talk about the Senate's approval of a $250 billion bill to boost technology research.
Wall Street Watch, a full update on the market's performance to date. Weekdays at 10:30, only here on the Financial Exchange Radio Network.
Hi, this is Mike Armstrong from the Armstrong Advisory Group. There are countless pitfalls that can occur when it comes to preparing a successful financial retirement strategy. It's not just about having enough money to live the way you want to, but also about understanding the variety of tax consequences that you may face based on your income level and your investment portfolio. Executing a strategy that addresses required minimum distributions, Social Security benefits, capital gains, and Roth IRA conversions are just a few of the factors that might be unique to your situation. In our new free guide called Building an Income Distribution Strategy will help you learn about these and other topics that can affect your ultimate plan. Call our office today at 800-393-4001 and get your copy of this free guide. Again, that number is 800-393-4001, or you can download it right now from our website, armstrongadvisory.com.
Securities offered through Securities America Incorporated, member FINRA SIPC, and advisory services offered through Securities America Advisors Incorporated. Securities America and its representatives do not provide tax advice. Therefore, it is important to coordinate with your tax advisor regarding your specific situation. Michael Armstrong, representative, Armstrong Advisory Group, and the Securities America companies are unaffiliated.
If you missed any part of today's show, not to worry. Go to financialexchangeshow.com and click listen. Then click on demand and catch up on every segment. You'll also find podcasts of all of our full shows. Just punch up that listen button at financialexchangeshow.com.
The Senate on Tuesday approved a bipartisan $250 billion bill boosting government spending on technology research and development amid rising competition from China and other nations. Is this all related to, you know, the ransomware and the attacks that we continue to be under?
No, I think this is much more geared towards dealing with potentially, providing an avenue for the federal government to explore new technologies, and also providing, it's turned into a bill that's providing some funding to deal with some of the supply chain blockages that we've seen in key areas like the semiconductor space. Mm-hmm. So $52 billion in this bill is allocated towards developing domestic semiconductor production as well. So I think that, you know, this is something where we've talked for a long time about how we don't want the U.S. government to be picking winners and losers. Mm-hmm. We don't want the government to be in the business of saying we think this company should succeed and this one shouldn't.
Right.
But there are key areas of the economy that if you don't have a coherent industrial policy, you end up in a situation like we have now where almost all of the semiconductors that the United States buys are produced overseas in Taiwan specifically.
Why did that shift occur? Was it cost? Was it skill set? Was
cost.
It natural resource?
Entirely cost.
Yeah.
And to a certain extent,
So you saved money in the short term, but then now it's biting us in the back.
Yeah, and I think that they're also, when you look at a lot of the components, not the components, but a lot of the materials that are used in high-tech manufacturing, A lot of them are also produced using processes that aren't really that friendly to the environment.
Yeah.
When you talk about, you know, refining silicon and things along those lines, these are not things that are environmentally friendly. And so I think there's been pushback on those things. I think having said that, though, you have to try to balance all of these different risks. You can say, look, we want to be as environmentally responsible as you want,
mm-hmm.
or as you can be. But ultimately, if you are trying to build these kinds of technologies, batteries, yep. solar panels, things along those lines, if all your production of the key materials are coming from overseas, yep. and you end up in a situation where you're dependent on one producer who is not necessarily friendly to American interests, I'm talking about China in case yep. anyone couldn't tell, then you have a situation where you're at the whim of you know, whatever they decide to do.
But there's several different industries that could be applied to, right? I mean, wouldn't you say the same thing perhaps about the aluminum industry and the steel industry?
Yes.
Where you need to have
domestic production,
and it hurts you because you have to pay more for that domestic production.
And it's in the areas where it has national security and, you know, public utility concerns.
Yeah.
When we're talking about if Hot Wheels wants to outsource their manufacturing of toy cars to
yep.
China, I don't really care, because if an American kid can't get a Hot Wheel for Christmas one year,
right.
it's not a huge problem. We'll figure out another present to right. get them. If you have, you know, if you're laying pipelines or if you're trying to put solar panels on roofs and China says, hey, we're going to stop exporting these materials or charge you X for these materials, then you run into a problem where you say, I can't do what I'm trying to
right.
do anymore. And what I'm trying to accomplish in terms of, you know, utilities and getting people
yeah.
power and water and things like that,
yeah.
if those things can't happen, you've got real problems then.
Right.
So I think that there's a place where you say, hey, for things that aren't mission critical, yeah, you let the free market decide. I don't care where
right.
Hot Wheels are produced. I don't care where T-shirts are made.
Well, what you're talking about is really the downside to globalization, right?
Yeah, and specifically, it's in these mission-critical areas
yeah.
where if you don't have them, people start to get hurt or die.
You know, what's interesting is we're talking about it now. We're looking at it in the rearview mirror. But I remember 10 years ago having these conversations about the potential for this type of thing
yep.
happening. And now we're living through it.
This legislation here, I think, is an important starting point.
Yeah, I was going to say it's not a lot of money.
It doesn't solve the problem. Again, and I know that industrial policy is not a popular thing to talk about in the U.S. because, you know, you say industrial policy and half the people start saying, oh, well, now you're talking about a managed economy. And the other half mm-hmm. say, well, now you're not managing the economy enough. And it's like, guys, we're just trying to solve one problem here.
Right.
But ultimately, you have to have some industries where you say, we can't just leave this up to the free market.
Because it's a national defense issue.
It's a huge issue when you're talking about, you know, military grade, you know, steel alloys
right.
and things like that. And, you know, being able to have enough PVC piping to lay all of the plumbing that you want if you're doing mm-hmm. construction in cities and things like that.
And the one that's most obvious is the computer chip.
Yep.
Right. Because you buy a car now, what are there, 400 or 500 computer chips in a car?
Well, when you can get them.
Yeah.
Now they have cars that they're just not including some of them, saying, well, we don't have this feature anymore.
Wow.
You know, so these are the kinds of things that I think are really important. And I think the next 18 to 24 months are going to be really interesting to see what happens with Taiwan specifically. Just when we're talking about the computer chip issue,
mm-hmm.
I don't think that Beijing wants to do anything with regards to Taiwan before the Olympics next year.
Mm-hmm.
They got the Olympics coming up in February of 2022.
Okay.
Because remember, we had the summer ones from last year pushed, so next
yep.
year's a Winter Olympics year,
yep.
and Beijing has them. I don't think anything's really changing before then.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at all of the everything that Beijing has done with regards to Hong Kong
yep.
in the last 2 years,
yeah.
and then all the
heavy hand
and all the signaling that they're doing about Taiwan now, watch the post-Olympic period to see if they look to institute a tighter level of control over Taiwan in that time period.
Right. Which gives us a very short window to try to make up some of these gaps.
The next couple of years are critically important.
Right, right. Because we can't be beholden
hugely
to them.
Important. This is going to be... The next decade is going to be determined by how the next year or two plays out.
Yeah.
On this specific issue when it comes to computer chips.
The ironic part is that the manufacturing may be done in Taiwan, but when you look at the research and where this stuff is actually being developed and invented,
Doesn't the bulk of that happen in the United States?
Yeah, and that's why you need to reform the whole university visa system. If you educate someone in the United States, right now here's the path to citizenship. You educate someone in the United States, then they have to apply for a green card after to be able to stay. There's no guarantee they get it unless they have a relationship with someone in the U.S. That's another 5 years. Then they can apply for citizenship. You're talking a 10-year period to be able to do that. I think you look at it and say, look, if you're getting educated in the U.S., apply your green card retroactively to when you begin from if you get a degree, if you graduate. And that way you graduate and then you have only one more year you need to do before you can become a U.S. citizen.
Yeah.
Yeah, let the
because then you can keep the kids that you're educating in the U.S. Actually,
yeah, you go look at a lot of these college campuses. You know, you look, the one that's most obvious is MIT.
Right? Yeah,
you look at the percentage of kids that would like to stay, and
you're pushing them out after you spend all this money and time educating them.
Hey, up next, Todd Lutsky from Cushing and Dolan will join us for our weekly estate planning segment. Stay with us.
Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at TFE Show. Breaking business news is always first, right here on the Financial Exchange Radio Network. Time now for Wall Street Watch. A complete look at what's moving markets so far today, right here on the Financial Exchange Radio Network.
This segment of the Financial Exchange is brought to you in part by Southern Airways Express, now with flights from Hanscom Field off 95. If you live north or west of Boston or in southern New Hampshire or Maine, Hanscom Field is the hassle-free way for you to get to Nantucket. Southern Airways Express, fast flights, low fares, book today at iFlySouthern.com. Taking a look around markets, whole bunch of meh. Today, once again, we've got the Dow up 18 points, the S&P's up 5, NASDAQ up 38, so about a 0.1% gain happening overall here. If we look at our sectors in the S&P 500, just taking a look at what is moving, we've got financials, industrials, and materials all down, so a little bit of a risk-off trade on that front. Healthcare, utilities, and communication services all up north of a third of a percent, so again, kind of a risk-off day, even though markets up overall. In terms of your biggest winners and losers in the market, best performing companies today, Fox Corporation, Twitter, and Regeneron all up north of 2% in the S&P. Then your biggest losers today, don't want to own any of these right now. Campbell Soup down 7% after some disappointing earnings. Dish Network down 4.5% after people somehow realize they're still in business. And Lincoln National down 2.5%. And that is Wall Street Watch.
This is Ask Todd on the Financial Exchange Radio Network. If you have an existing estate plan or are in the market for one, Todd Lutsky is here to answer your questions and help you plan for later life. Ask Todd is presented by Cushing & Dolan, serving Massachusetts and New England for more than 35 years, helping families with estate and tax planning, Medicaid planning, and probate law. Visit CushingDolan.com. Now, here's Todd Lutsky.
Once a week, we have the opportunity to talk to Todd Lutsky, our resident estate planning attorney, about a variety of topics. And by the way, if you have a question for Todd, you might want to queue up early. We're going to be having a conversation regarding life estates. Our phone number in the studio is 888-205-2263. Todd, good morning. And let's get into this topic of life estates. Why do people create life estates in the first place? What, you know, I think it behooves us to have a conversation as to what they are and why they're created.
Because they're simple. Yeah. That's why people do them. They think they're simple and they think they're cheap and they're, you know, inexpensive. And but yeah, you know,
what's
you,
the purpose?
You get
of
what
it,
you
though?
Pay for. So the purpose is to generally try to protect your home from the cost, and it's just your home. Don't try to do a life estate with your rental property, your vacation home,
primary residence.
Yeah, you do it with your home, and with your primary residence, it's a way of trying to protect it from the cost of long-term care. You know,
or other creditors, by the way? Or is it like, let's say you create a life estate and somebody gets a legal judgment against you for non-payment of debt or something like that. Does it protect you from that?
It does, but it really doesn't. I mean, it does in the sense that I guess the creditor could go after your life estate, but they really can't move against it while you're living, so I guess it's protected. But again, they wouldn't get anything. It's like if you went after me, Barry, and you got my life estate, okay, here, I give it to you. As soon as I die, you have nothing.
Oh, really?
It evaporates on the moment of the life tenant's death. So you'd be hanging on to an empty bucket.
Gotcha.
So it's, gotcha. It doesn't really do much for the creditors.
All right. So then give the let's go back to the conversation about why people are using them. You say because they're inexpensive to do. But they're very tax inefficient.
Well, they're not only very tax inefficient. They're just when they're done, where you take them and you give them to your child, and you retain the right to live there. They create a lot of headaches. They create a lot of not only tax inefficiencies but creditors. You say, yeah, maybe they're not going to come after you as the life tenant, Barry, but they certainly, you know, your son and your daughter have the property. They get a divorce while you're living. That's an asset of the marriage.
Gotcha.
That future interest that they hold.
Yeah.
Is an asset of the marriage. It's a completed gift to them. So you've got a gift tax situation when you set it up.
You end up buying back your house from your ex-daughter-in-law.
That's not helpful, right? No. So, I mean, you've got those issues. So, and you know, if you try to sell it, you've got the problem of from a tax standpoint, that, you know, a large chunk of the proceeds based on your age, the life tenant, could end up in the hands of the remainderman.
Right.
The future interest holders. And if they don't live there, they end up getting not only more of the proceeds, but they have a tax liability.
Right.
Whereas if it's your primary residence, you guys get a married couple gets a $500,000 exclusion and a single person gets $250,000 exclusion.
At what age do people start having these conversations in your experience? You know, you do estate planning for a living. You talk to dozens of families. At what age do you have that conversation with your folks, or do you have that conversation with your siblings as to, gee, it might be time to consider, you know, either a life estate or an irrevocable trust?
Yeah, 60 and up, 60? 65 and up, you know, somewhere in that range. I mean, I bring it up to clients, you know, and in there, when they cross the 60 threshold, 65, in that range, I'm going to mention it. I'm going to just ask, is it on your mind? Is it something you're thinking about yet? You know, as one of the objectives that you want to accomplish today. So that's when I bring it up. So I'd say that's probably a good age.
You have voiced some criticism today and in the past about the use of life estates.
Yeah. I would say that the way you're going to do them, the biggest problem, no matter how you do them, is when you end up selling your house as a life tenant, assuming you can, and mostly you can, the problem is you're always going to get back a piece of the money based on your age as a life tenant. And if you're going to get back a portion of the proceeds and you're older, well, those are at risk all over again for the nursing home. I don't care whether I make the remainder interest a life, the children, or I put the remainder interest in an irrevocable trust, which, by the way, those are the two ways to form them.
Yep.
And if you're going to do them, please make the remainder interest holder the irrevocable trust and not the kids. You avoid all the kids' creditor problems. You avoid asking the kids for permission to sell the property.
Yep.
You avoid all the adverse capital gains tax problems because it's a grantor trust and you get your full exclusion. So you avoid all the headaches by having the remainder interest in the trust.
Let's define who we are talking to and who might want to consider calling into the show now.
Sure.
Somebody over the age of 60, 65.
Yep.
Somebody who owns their own home.
Yeah, right? Definitely.
What else? What are the other qualifying factors that they should be considering? Do they need to be married?
No, you could be married. You could be single.
You have to
widow,
have kids.
Divorce. You don't have to have kids, but you know, you might have nieces and nephews. You might have somebody that you want the house to go to.
Charity.
But with a charity, you probably wouldn't be doing a life estate.
Okay.
You can't really do a life estate with the remainder interest in the charity. But yeah, I would say
if you have family that you want to leave your home to. So if you're a homeowner and you're saying to yourself, well, gee, I'd like to make sure this goes to the home as opposed to the state in which I live, give us a call. Our phone number is toll-free. It's 888-205-2263. We invite all homeowners who are concerned about protecting their home from the high cost of nursing homes to give us a ring. 888-205-2263.
Ask Todd with Todd Lutsky every Wednesday at 10:30, only here on the Financial Exchange Radio Network. Life estates are not simple documents. There are many pitfalls in using them, from hidden gift issues to income tax consequences to the potential for a loss of control of your estate. On the other hand, irrevocable trusts provide specific protections that many families are interested in, such as keeping your assets out of probate and potentially avoiding estate taxes. If you haven't done your planning yet, now's the time to learn the difference between a trust and a life estate.
Cushing and Dolan are experts in estate planning and taxation, and their new guide out for June, called The Difference Between Life Estates and Irrevocable Trusts, will educate you on both products and give you clear guidance as to which one makes the most sense for your estate plan. Don't leave your assets to chance. Call 866-848-5699 and get your free guide today. Cushing and Dolan have been helping New England families for more than 30 years. Let them help you too. That's 866-848-5699. Or download the guide right now on their website, LegalExchangeShow.com. That's LegalExchangeShow.com. You're listening to Ask Todd with Todd Lutsky on the Financial Exchange Radio Network.
We're having a conversation about life estates and irrevocable trusts. These are tools that people use to protect their homes. And if you have a question on that topic, feel free to give us a ring. Our number is 888-205-2263. Let's talk about the pros and cons of using an irrevocable trust, Todd, if you will, versus a life estate.
And I think I might throw in there, if I didn't do it before, you know, when do you create them?
Yeah.
Because I'm already down on them overall. I'm not a big fan of life estates, but so many people do them.
Right.
So I think the first question I would have is really, you know, why would I do it? Why wouldn't I just do the irrevocable trust and put the whole house in? Which I'm more on,
right,
on top of that. I like that idea. And then that works for rental properties, vacation homes, money. You don't have to. You don't have to think about it.
By the way, folks, that's what I did, but not that that's pertinent.
No, but that's important to do, and so, but I would say that the few times that you would do one of these life estates would be if you have a house that is a two family and you're renting the upstairs, you might want, you know, to rent. You might keep a life estate so you don't have to run the rent through the trust. You can have collect the rent directly.
Okay.
Yeah, and that's just convenience.
Yep.
It's easy. I would say in many homes, at least in New England, especially here in Massachusetts, but, you know, check with your town, of course, they give you these abatements. You ever hear of them? Or like if you...
Property tax abatements?
Yeah, if you own the property, you get an abatement. Over 65, veterans, you get a reduction in your real estate tax bill. Now, it might not be tons of money, but, you know, maybe a couple thousand a year, $3,000-$4,000
a year. It's meaningful.
Meaningful. And so if you have that, then you want to keep the life estate, because if you put the whole house in the trust, you'll lose that exemption. And you don't want to lose that exemption.
Right.
And so by keeping a life estate, you've reserved the right to live there. You're still the present owner. And so therefore you do not lose that abatement. And you know, the last reason I would do it is it doesn't happen all that often, but there's still folks that want to do Medicaid planning that still have an outstanding mortgage on their house or or a lingering home equity line, right? I want to keep that life estate when I put the house in so I don't trigger the due on sale clause on the mortgage. And that way I can keep it, I can tap my equity line, etc. So those are the three times I do them.
And that would make some sense as to why one would continue. What's the time process in terms of trying to create one of these? How long does it take to do one?
Oh, you can do them relatively quickly. I mean, if you're doing just a life estate, I mean, to me, it would be coupling it with the irrevocable trust, which is the way I would do it. That takes a little longer. I would say you got to create the trust. You got to spend some time getting the estate plan in order. And the life estate piece is short.
All right.
Short money.
As promised, we're going to go to the phones. I'll remind you, our number is toll free. It's 888-205-2263. Pam is in Marshfield and has a question for Todd Lutsky. Pam, welcome to the show. What is your question, please?
My question is, my mother has a small cottage in Rhode Island, and my brother has no children, and I have one child. And my mother recently told me that she wants to leave it to my child, the cottage, that is.
Uh-huh.
And in terms of, I'm just concerned, like, what if something happened and my child was in a car accident or liability? And having this type of piece of property, what would, like... My child is 23 years old, so, you know, whether she gets married, I want to make sure it's protected.
Yeah.
Do you would putting it in some sort of like a revocable trust be the appropriate thing, or irrevocable trust?
So what I would do now is
and just let me add one element. There's a little tension between my brother and myself.
Yeah, of course that always flares things up, and which is exactly why I would never recommend. And this is a carte blanche answer. I would never recommend having your mom give directly to the grandchild, to any grandchild, the property, period.
But that's what she wants to do.
No, we're going to get there, though, but we're not going to do it this way. We're not going to give it to them outright now while mom is living. Okay. So mom is not going to, while she's alive, give it to that grandchild for all the reasons that she's saying, right? One, I don't want a grandchild owning the real estate. I just don't. So what am I going to do? One, if I do it that way, I lose my step up in basis because I've given it away during life. So that's not helpful for the grandchild who might want to sell it at some point in the future. Mm-hmm. Always better to die owning it and get a step up in basis so that grandchild will have less capital gains tax in the future. Number two, I would have her set up, your mom that is, set up an irrevocable trust now and put this house, this cottage, in it. That will avoid probate. That will protect it from the cost of long-term care after 5 years. So get it in there. That will allow it to get to the child with a full step up in basis, the grandchild.
Does it do anything to decrease the friction between Pam and her sibling?
I think whether it decreases the friction or not, it at least takes Pam out of the equation.
Yeah.
Pam says, look,
this is something
mom
did.
This is something mom did. I had nothing to do with it. I didn't do it. I can't guarantee that he's going to, you know,
right,
be not upset about it, but at least it takes the pressure off of her,
right,
to say, I didn't do it. You know, mom did it on her
these
own.
These are mom's wishes.
Absolutely. And I think that's the way to go. And so now that you have it in there, here's some more reasons that Pam was talking about that she was worried about by doing this. Now, it ultimately will get to the grandchild. The trust doesn't have to end when mom dies.
Well, that was going to be my question. What if Pam's daughter, who's 23 now, inherits the property when she's 35?
Yeah.
And then she gets
married and has kids. And
right, right.
Gets a divorce.
Right.
Yeah, I know. And
I didn't want to say that, Pam, but it just, nobody wishes that on their child, obviously.
But if the grandchild then keeps this trust in play, you could have language in the trust that says, okay, she could be the trustee. She can manage the money. She can buy and sell property if mm-hmm. she wanted to. She can, and then have a disinterested trustee make discretionary distributions out to her if she needs it. Well, the nice part about it is it's just a house. So as long as it's just a cottage, there's not going to be anything coming out anyway.
Right.
Meanwhile, because it's owned in the trust and she doesn't have direct access to it, she gets it through another party.
Mm-hmm.
There's a divorce. Let's say I'm the disinterested trustee. And there's a divorce. And later on, the spouse's attorney right. says,
what about what about that cottage in Rhode Island?
Yeah, I'd like half that cottage, please. You know, that's how things work when you get a divorce. And then the grandchild says, that's a great idea, but it's not mine. You have to ask Todd. He's a disinterested trustee, so it really does everything.
Folks, don't forget, you can receive Todd's guide. It's all about life estates when compared to irrevocable trusts. If you own a home, it's a must read. You can receive the guide by visiting legalexchangeshow.com, or you can call Todd's office at 866-848-5699 to receive the guide. It's all about life estates and irrevocable trusts. 866-848-5699. And don't forget Todd's weekend show, The Legal Exchange. It airs both Saturday and Sunday on many of these network stations. If you want more specifics about the topics we've discussed this morning, make sure you tune in on the station nearest you. You can find the complete list of radio stations and airtimes at legalexchangeshow.com. Any final comments on these trusts?
I'm going to just one more on the Pam question is, we went all through this discussion and guess what we didn't mention at all? A life estate, right? We don't normally do them. We don't always need them. People do them and they make mistakes when they do them. And I'm trying to, and I think this guide will show you the difference between the two. But in this case, it was, hey, put the whole cottage in the trust.
Right.
Get the whole darn thing protected. No need for a life estate. And it's going to accomplish not only during life, but it goes on after mom dies.
And much better from an income tax perspective.
Way
right?
better than like say, from an income tax
potentially
perspective.
Saving hundreds of thousands of dollars of income tax.
Capital gains tax, yeah. Absolutely.
This has been Ask Todd on the Financial Exchange Radio Network. Ask Todd with Todd Lutsky has been presented by Cushing & Dolan, serving Massachusetts and New England for more than 30 years, helping families with estate and tax planning, Medicaid planning, and probate law. Call 800-393-4001 or visit CushingDolan.com.
Markets are up modestly this morning. I think it's important to keep in mind that we're going to get an inflation report tomorrow, and that is something that could have a dramatic effect on equity prices. The S&P is up 5 points. The Dow is up 40 points. The NASDAQ is up 34 points. Crude oil is trading at $70 a barrel. Gold is down $1.90 an ounce at $18.92. And let's take a look at the 10-year Treasury. 10-year Treasury note yields are down to 1.49%, and Bitcoin is up $3,000 a coin, currently trading at $35,128 per coin. We'll be right back with more on the Financial Exchange.